Hello again. I'm Sarah Shear, the president of Eco Agriculture Partners based here in Washington, D.C. I really enjoyed the morning very much to see these three extremely rich cases of very active work going on in terms of integrating across agriculture, livelihoods, and ecosystem management. And I was looking for five things when I was looking at each of these, at these groups. I was looking, first of all, for strong field and farm level practices that were both profitable and productive and also were making these production systems sustainable. And I saw a lot of that in all of them, a real diversity of innovative approaches to managing those production systems. I heard a lot of talk about value chain. I wasn't 100% sure that the value chain activities were actually linked to those production practices or if it was parallel, and maybe that's something that, you know, you could talk about later, because I think the extent to which the value chain work is explicitly working also with the sustainable practices, that's obviously going to be more sustainable. The second thing I would be looking at would be community level collective action around those resources which need to be managed in a community level. I heard a lot about that. That's something AID has done really well for a really long time. So I'm confident that it's there. I wasn't sure how much those were directly linked with the agricultural production systems, and I would be interested to know more about that. The third thing I was looking for was managing landscapes specifically to support agriculture, to make agriculture more productive, to make it more sustainable. I heard a lot about that in relationship to irrigation management, in relationship to watershed management, although I it wasn't always clear that the link was rigorous. And I'm guessing that there's a lot of background research that wasn't there. But that's something that I think as a community globally, we need to be better at being able to really direct where you're actually going to expect a productivity growth now. When would you be expected? This is for sustainability in 20 years. I didn't see so much about things besides water. The pollination and some of the other issues that, you know, that I suspect is really there and important. The fourth area that I was looking for was development of agricultural production systems and investments that were good for ecosystem services and biodiversity. And I heard a lot of conventional natural resource management interventions that were really good. Let's protect the mangroves, let's protect the forests, that kind of thing, but not so much that the agricultural systems themselves, that the core agricultural development was necessarily emphasizing that. And I'd be interested to know the extent to which that direction is moving. And then finally, I was looking for stakeholder platforms for long-term collaboration and planning and assessment jointly, problem-solving together and investment. And it did seem like there was a lot of discussion about that, certainly at the local level, at the landscape level, and even at the national level. So I thought those were all really, really important advances. There were five things I'll just say quickly that I encourage you this afternoon. Unfortunately, I won't be able to be with you this afternoon, but I would really love to get the notes from discussions that would particularly talk about the strengthening of spatial planning. I saw maps, but I didn't see spatial planning. And I'm guessing it's underlying a lot of the work in the three places, but I just think that this is a core tool, if we're really serious about integrating production and ecosystem management, that the stakeholder group can sit around maps and do planning around maps and fight over the maps and what's really happening where and how do we get these components together. The second one is I heard a lot about difficulties of getting attention at the national level in terms of the core political support for this approach. We're working on the agricultural green growth strategy for Tanzania. It's really too bad she had to leave before that. But we're working with the SAGCOT corridor. And the idea is they have a corridor plan, but they're trying to make their corridor plan look more like, I guess what you were saying, a watershed plan would be, that it was looking at the full range of services and products from that area. And it's still clear that the people with the real money and energy and power is really, they want lots of rice production out of that area. And I think a lot of strategies for engaging with policymakers, study tours, whatever it might be, would be key. The third one is this question of scale that a couple of you all raised. Are you, in terms of the tracking, we've got some really good indicators and monitoring processes, but can we really say, how much has to happen before you're actually going to have an impact? particularly on some of these ecosystem functions, and what can we do better around that. The fourth thing I heard from a lot of people that really worth some more discussion is this handling of the different financing flows. And when are you better off to try to link the financial flows together? And when should we just make each individual financial flow more flexible so that you can do integrated, investment around it? And finally, my last one is I heard a lot about tracking and monitoring. It seemed to be more for donors. And I'd like to hear more about that because I actually think that this tracking issue is very powerful for bringing stakeholder groups together. And to the extent that they're working on it, I think that would be really interesting. And I'm going to just close by doing a little mini advertisement. The World Resources Institute and Conservation International, who are here and ourselves, are part of a group of 10 institutions worldwide that have launched last year this Landscapes for People, Food, and Nature initiative, which is actually trying to support initiatives like the ones that the USAID is doing through knowledge exchange between groups working in landscapes, working with policymakers to try to create a more enabling environment and investment programs. And I would invite those of you who are here who are working in landscapes to join in and help us learn from the work that you're doing and perhaps actually even some of these specific sites, there might be landscapes that could be part of the learning network for the landscape. So I'll stop there.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you. It's been a fascinating session. I walked in today thinking about sort of, no pun intended, the perfect storm. That is happening in terms of rising extremes in weather. I was reflecting this morning on the IPCC report that came out last fall talking about how, extremes in heat, extremes in wetness, how that's going to happen. How that's really going to go down. Sort of, that's one aspect of the storm. Rising population, increasing urban concentrations, and then therefore the emphasis and the pressure on food production. And it's been an interesting morning, both kind of sobering and encouraging to hear each of the missions reflect that, both in terms of the specific climate challenges they're facing. Kimberly this morning talking about plain old weather and how it ain't what she used to be in terms of, what's changed there. And that also being reflected, obviously, by Agatha in terms of her commentary, and then Merlene talking in great depth about, month by month, what's changing, and then what do you do as a farmer? What decisions do you make? And I think that we need to take this and apply against it, what are the tools and technology? So my perspective coming into this is really from the technologies and tools, and what are disruptive technologies that can really be put to bear to aid in this, bevy of adaptation measures that are available to us, such that we know which adaptation measure is appropriate where and when. So we've talked a lot, and there's been some good conversation about weather and climate data. The fact that there's not much good data out there off of which people can base decisions. And that, of course, happens to be what each of us at our company lives and breathes and sleeps and dreams. In terms of how do you get local data? How do you get that in real time? How do you put that to work? How can you use that to make decisions? So we've done some work, and one of my colleagues, and I applaud him for walking off a plane from India, sitting here in the front row, Jim Anderson, he's done a lot of this work, actually, and I'm delighted you were able to get yourself from the airplane showered in here, Jim. emphasis on showered. in Canada, for example, in terms of how we've been able to deploy weather sensor networks and use that to specifically increase food crop production. And without going into much detail about that, the decision making is really just as Merlene talked about. How do you know when to plant? What are your optimal number of growing days? When do you apply pesticide? Pesticide is expensive. What irrigation decisions do you make? We talked about drip irrigation and a number of other techniques. And so, I would like to offer to the group as we go into this afternoon, I think it's one of the breakout sessions too, how can we put technology to work To help us make smarter investment decisions. The other aspect of technology, not lost to any of you, I'm sure, is the fact that there's over 6 billion mobile phones globally. And obviously that's being used in a lot of ways in the ag sector in terms of commodity prices and market decisions and that sort of thing. And so what's the opportunity to integrate early warnings via that platform? And how could that aid in boosting food production? And then the final thing I'd like to just, you know, emphasize, and I was struck by this in a number of different mission presentations, is the criticality of public-private partnerships, because this challenge is so enormous that it's too big for any sector to tackle by itself. So we are big proponents of that, and really the ideal scenario would be, you talked about 3,000 people, you know, perishing with the floods. How can you get information about flash flooding in a way that involves the NMHS or the National Meteorological and Hydrological Group in a given country as a critical stakeholder? How can you get a private sector company to help partner with them? This is some of the kind of work we've done in Brazil, and we're hoping actually to establish a pilot in Haiti in the same way. And how can that really help from a technology transfer and capacity building standpoint, you know, the ag sector and expand to transportation, utilities, so many things that are impacted by flash floods, for example, or drought or tropical storms that come up. So, you know, my emphasis really is more from a how can we leverage disruptive technologies to aid in this adaptation set of things we're doing. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Yes, thank you. Once again, I'm Tanya Rall with CARE USA. And, you know, first, I do really want to thank the missions. I think you've done an amazing amount of work just to think through this. And I'm impressed with just how aware you are of the complexities and your commitment to really addressing them. You know, it struck me earlier this week, USAID had their Frontiers in Development Conference, and I look at integration as the frontier. This is really where one of the most critical next steps can be taken. And that's really about integrating not just Feed the Future, natural resource management, and climate change, but integrating gender and integrating health, integrating across a lot of different sectors and what previously have often been silos. I do want to give some credit where credit is due to the missions. There are a lot of things from the presentations that I found very encouraging. Again, just that awareness, the awareness in Cambodia, not just of the environmental complexities, but the social, political, and economic complexities. When you talk about climate change, it's much more than just the environment. It's much more than just natural resources. It has a very significant relationship with social, political, and economic dynamics. Also, just recognizing that, you know, some of the technical interventions, I noticed the example you gave, Marilyn, in terms of targeting technology to the consumer, recognizing that there are different kinds of technologies for different audiences, and that's incredibly beneficial. It's not a one-size-fits-all. Then looking also at the combination of interventions, working disaster risk management into a food security program addresses both, you know, significant impacts on food security, things like the mangroves and how they're able to help preserve plantains, but then also working in things like WASH to make sure that as climate impacts are increasing, there are health impacts associated with that, and realizing that WASH is then part of that. And then also just the efforts that have been done to increase coordination, not just among donors, but also with national governments, both in the Haitian context and then also in the Cambodian context, really liaising with the national government to address what is often a challenge of getting the government to see that this is really important. I also want to acknowledge some of the challenges that you highlighted, the information gaps. I'm going to talk about the role of just generating data and really getting that data to the farmer in an accessible format. That's something that for a farmer helps build his or her ability to plan even after the assistance is gone, that mobile technology is there. Up-to-date weather and climate forecasts are gotten to farmers so that as rainfall patterns shift, They know when to plant. They know when to harvest, especially as Agatha mentioned in Tanzania, traditional ways of predicting rainfall patterns aren't working as well as they did 20 years ago. And then again, some of those socioeconomic and political complexities, the lack of capacity, the challenge of generating buy-in, and then the balance between short-term wins and long-term analysis. The final reflections I want to share are sort of the framework for how I would look at integrating natural resource management and particularly climate change. And it really starts first with that data piece, starting with the projections before strategies are set, before priorities are chosen, so that if there's a crop that won't be viable in 20 years, you don't pick that as one of your value chains. That data, though, is also about some of those complexities in terms of power dynamics. Looking at the gender context, the Cambodian gender context actually highlights that gender is not about women. It's about women and men. It's about understanding how gender dynamics impact control over natural resources. If in a household, say in the highlands of Peru, the men are responsible for crops that are sold in the market and the women are responsible for crops that are used at a household consumption level, and both of them require water, which of those is prioritized as water availability starts to shift in 10, 15 years? Do you sacrifice the market or do you sacrifice household consumption? Overlaying those gender considerations on natural resource management and climate impacts to really start to understand that not only are each of them cross-cutting, but they actually have to cross-cut against themselves. Taking that framework then from analysis and information and then looking at interventions, this starts to address some of the challenges. The lack of capacity, prioritizing capacity building and coordination at a local level, a national level, and with the private sector helps build that buy-in. It helps build long-term sustainability so that what we're doing isn't just introducing a technical intervention that has to be maintained, but we're actually building the capacity of farmers to make decisions on their own 10, 15 years from now, to have access to the political, the economic, and the social assets that they need to really enhance their own adaptive capacity. For us, climate change is much more than increasing the ability of farmers to cope with shocks. It's really about increasing their ability to shape, create, and adopt their own solutions in the face of uncertainty. So those are just some of the considerations I'll put out there for our later discussion.